Coming up now is an interview with Leslie Gregory. Leslie is the founder of Right to Health, a group dedicated to creating a network committed to alleviating the effects of racism. Leslie is a physician's assistant, Navy vet, and social justice activist who studies the health impacts of racism with a clinical and public health lens. She sat down with KBOO's Althea Billings to discuss the importance of intersectionality in mediation work, why claiming to be colorblind erases people's experiences, and how being an anti-racist is an active daily practice.
My name is Leslie Gregory, and I'm a physician assistant since 2000. And I started my nonprofit in 2006, which was initially started about health disparities and heart disease, which is kind of the focus of my practice, and then shifted into looking for the cause of it as my practice progressed, as my experience progressed in terms of looking for causes instead of just kind of band-aid approach to health problems. And so we've been doing it since then. I have been fighting the health effects of racism for a very long time. Started with my mom, who started a mobile unit back in my hometown in Ohio. And that's kind of what mentored me into medicine in the first place.
Yeah, and so your organization, Right to Health US, has a campaign to get racism declared a public health crisis. The CDC has certain parameters for determining what falls into a health crisis. And you say that racism meets those guidelines. Can you walk me through some of that?
Sure. So the guidelines are very clear, and we can see how they are actually being played out right now in the health crisis of the virus. And so these four criteria, which, you know, I should mention, are not just viral. They're not just, you know, associated with pathogens. They are conditions when these are met, constitute a health crisis. So, for instance, the virus certainly qualifies, but so did some of the other health crises in the past, like HIV. So the four criteria are, first, that it's a burden on society, whether that's financial or in life or in, you know, whatever type of terms, it's a burden. The other is that this burden is disproportionately shared by a certain segment of the population. So for instance, pregnant women or, you know, people who smoke or drivers, you know, like seatbelt and all the car crashes that were happening before seatbelts were instituted. The third is that current measures are insufficient, meaning it's declared a crisis because what we started trying wasn't working. So current measures are insufficient. And then the fourth is that there's evidence that upstream change will make a difference. In other words, you know, local efforts, clinical efforts in the clinic, you know what I mean? You know, band-aid approaches are not working. That means it's typically institutional. And that's when we get our national health services like CDC, NIH, Surgeon General, these sort of institutional changes are brought in and called in. And so that's why, for instance, CDC has put, you know, this huge effort into creating vaccine, you know, things like that. So those are the four criteria. And once they're met, and again, these criteria are in place for a reason, so that emotion, politics, you know, bias, etc., should be sort of programmed out. Once you set these criteria, it's no longer a matter of political will or opinion or, you know, this sort of thing. It's supposed to be clinical. Once those things are met, then the dominoes fall and, you know, these programs are set into place, budget is freed up, access, etc. And it's so interesting that the virus is happening at this time because it does show us exactly what a public health crisis calls for. And as you can see, you know, these sort of protocols have been instituted.
Right. It's not in the abstract. What are some examples of how race factors into health?
And this is another one of those things that's been very well documented and which puts clinicians like myself into this sort of baffling role because, for instance, we know, at least I see, you know, every day, the impacts of racism for everyone. And I think that's the difference between the protocol that I proposed and others that have also tried to address racism. One of the things we see is an increased level of just sort of stress response, whether it's increased blood pressure or difficulty controlling behaviors. Often that is the way it manifests for some people, is just, you know, compulsive behaviors, what we call coping mechanisms, but often adapt into maladaptive coping mechanisms. So for instance, a person who will smoke or drink initially may start out with that behavior as a coping mechanism. You know, you pick up a cigarette, it gives you that break, right? You just take it, you know, take the cigarette out on the back porch or whatever, and you get away, right? Smoke break. That's how that kind of came about. And of course, in the moment, it feels relaxing. You take that smoke break and you feel like, okay, I can go back to working. I can go back to whatever stressful job or situation I'm in. Same with alcohol. You take this drink and initially it feels, you know, euphoric. It lets you separate from the stress. But over time, those repetitive behaviors, you know, right? Obviously, they lead to habituation, addiction, the inability to stop, et cetera. So that's one of the ways that stress, and again, racism is sort of this kind of ongoing low-level stress, may manifest in your life. It's through these kinds of behaviors. Sometimes it's overeating. You know, sometimes it's just getting anger out. It can be abusive behaviors. You know, we see, and again, we see these sorts of things right now during the virus where people are locked in. And often that's what racism does. It isolates people. And so just like the virus is doing that, and we're seeing the stress of isolation, imagine an entire culture being marginalized in this way and isolated and having rights taken away and having excluded from services, jobs, you know, that kind of thing. And that's what racism does. It alienates people, and race itself becomes this predetermining factor, which if you look at the actual science behind it, there really is no biologic correlate to race. It is entirely cultural in the perception of it. You know, skin color does not determine, you know, very much more than just skin color. And yet, because it's easily identifiable, it becomes this other determining factor where people look at skin color and then make all these other assumptions, right? There's, you know, so many other things attached to that that are not appropriate, that may be visually simple to draw, but in actuality are mistaken. And so that's another reason that racism is directly associated with stress and these kinds of behaviors, because it's a misnomer. It's a mistake. It's an easily made visual misperception that allows us to ascribe other characteristics and factors to what is in actuality nothing more than a change in melanin. So you can see how the brain would see this and think simply on the surface, oh, there's this big difference. But deep inside, there's an awareness that there really is no difference, and here I am alienating this group of people. And so that's how I believe racism affects not just people of color, but also dominant culture. There is a misperception that deeply, deeply offends the psyche.
Yeah, and it's an interesting distinction to make. I think sometimes people get tripped up on the idea that race is a social construct, which means that it is society that gives it meaning. But as I was looking at things from your organization, Right to Health US, it has a real impact on public health, and it's been studied already with these sort of code words like social determinants of health. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, sure. And I think this is, again, one of those things that's associated with stress. You know, we are trying to find other ways to describe, study, manage, educate around racism. We're trying to find other ways to do that that are less triggering, which we understand that. You know, who wouldn't understand that? We're trying to find other ways to describe it because we know, and this is, you know, another human phenomenon, after you use a word multiple times, it's going to become either pejorative or it becomes colloquial or it gets triggering or you've heard it so many times that it no longer has the initial meaning. And this is what has happened. As soon as you start using racism over and over and over, it becomes triggering, particularly to dominant culture. So this is why we start to use other words like social determinants of health, which, you know, in fact, do include other things. It, you know, social determinants include, you know, other things which are, you know, environmental, you know, dietary, all these other things, but almost all these other things can be associated again to the institution of racism, right? And that's the issue. It's an institutional issue. You know, back in the day when I was growing up, racism initially just sort of meant that thing that, you know, white people do that is harmful, you know, calling one person a bad name. You know, that's racist. That's racism. And over time, again, as our perceptions and descriptive terms have changed, it now becomes this institutional issue. And so it is a system of granting worth or withholding worth based on skin color. So things have changed over time, and that has to happen. You know, it has to happen. After we use words so many times, you know, the dictionary is a living document. It is a changing and evolving. So this is what happens. And once you use a word like, or, you know, not even a word, a phrase, for instance, Black Lives Matter, for instance, you know, these are all phrases that have changed over time. And that's what's happening to words. And when we start using these words over and over, they start triggering people. And before you know it, racism itself, the word, the sound, the repetitive syllable themselves can create physical responses from people. So, you know, when, as soon as you say a word, people begin to get triggered. And so using these, you know, social determinants, et cetera, becomes another way of discussing something, hopefully without that triggering. Now, what we know, of course, particularly living here, is that hasn't happened. You know, people are still being quite triggered by these words, and pretty soon it becomes code for racism. So that's another way that stress of all groups can be increased by this. And very often it becomes, in our culture, it becomes this sort of white and black thing, but we have to remember that the rainbow that is the United States has varying degrees of marginalization based on skin tone, even within and out groups, right? So, and, you know, again, it becomes this sort of issue of colorism. And these are all very subtle, you know, differences. There may be a very subtle difference between racism as experienced by, for instance, a Vietnamese individual or a Filipino individual, and that was an issue. So, like I said, it, you know, depending on what in-group you're discussing and what out-group you're discussing, these issues of what I call othering can be, you know, they're raised. They become an issue.
In the realm of public health, how does a more colorblind, quote-unquote, mentality limit or damage meaningful treatment of issues?
So that is a really big, important piece, because particularly in areas like Portland, where there are fewer people of color, there's less diversity than more. People like to use that phrase and say, well, you know, I just don't see color. And so this colorblind approach really can be more damaging in the process of trying to work with communities of color, because what it literally feels like in that moment, and again, this can be fairly bizarre to people who are not living it, is it means you don't see me. And that means that you're not accepting those experiences that I'm trying to tell you about, or that I am expressing, whether it's to you or to the general population or to my boss or to people who I'm trying to get to change behavior, as this sort of denial. You know, it's a denial. I don't see color. Well, that means you don't see the effects that I'm trying to explain to you in the moment. That means you don't acknowledge the very damage that I'm seeking to repair. And the point is, whether or not you see it, it's affecting you. So whether or not you accept it, you have a certain level of privilege. And again, privilege is another one of those words, like I said, that starts to become triggering, has become colloquial, and becomes jargon. Eventually, you can use that as a part of dominant culture to say, okay, they said I have privilege. They said I am racist. They said, when I don't see color, which also means I don't see my privilege, right? And so that, again, creates this barrier to acceptance of my experience. And that's how people who say, you know, I don't see color, it feels like what you're really trying to say is you don't see the issue I'm trying to raise in the moment. And so you're able, if you say you don't see color, you're able to deny my experience. And that's not acceptable.
Yeah, I also understand that your organization has been called in for some mediation work. Can you tell me about that?
I think the biggest experience I've ever gotten in mediation is sitting in a clinic working with patients. Because, you know, very often a patient will come in who's diabetic and I'll say, look, before we address your diet, before we address your glucose and your weight and the things associated with diabetes, you know, I need to see what you're eating. And so an assessment is the first step. And then we negotiate from where a patient is to where a patient needs to be. And that's mediation, right? That's negotiation. And so that's what I try to approach with working with an anti-racist health-centered campaign, not just with health, quote, disparities. So people are thinking, okay, minority populations are at higher risk for systemic disease. And of course, that's true. But in a racist culture, and again, we're not talking about individual races. We're talking about institutions. We're talking about what's in the water, right? Where if you look at our country as a soup, the broth itself is racism. And so when you're trying to go negotiate through a culture of othering, marginalization, abuse, et cetera, you really have to approach it in that way. And so that's how we look at it. We do assessments first. We say, okay, where are we? As a part of the health negotiation, if you will, we're looking at first, where are you? And then we negotiate through, where do we want to get? And that's how negotiation in health is accomplished. And so we are hoping to have more opportunities to negotiate from a health perspective, the kind of marginalization, for instance, the violence we're seeing on the street. This is in everyone's best interest to address, not just those communities that are particularly in the crosshairs in the moment. And that's probably familiar to your listeners as the all boats rise phenomenon. And that's the other thing that we, you know, rely heavily on, the understanding that if you address these issues for communities of color, then the benefits to all of society vastly outweigh the costs.
In doing this work, are there misconceptions that you encounter when you try to advocate for racism as a public health crisis?
Yeah, there are lots of. Yeah, there are lots of obstacles. And I think the biggest one is denial. And again, that is a coping mechanism that we're very familiar with. It is not isolated to any culture. This is not a puzzle. This is a very common coping mechanism that individuals, cultures, societies adapt. It's a way of, if you can think of a drowning person, under stress, right? That's the ultimate of stress. You're drowning, you feel your life is at risk. And so you reach out for whatever you can that seems to be buoyant in that moment. That's a coping mechanism. It doesn't matter what it is. Like we talked about, a person who's under a great deal of stress may light that cigarette up in the moment. It may feel like a great buoy, right? Something I can hold on to that just keeps me up, keeps my nose out of the water for 5 minutes before I go back into the fray, you know. That is a misperception that happens all the time. If I can just do something right now, to make me feel better. And so denial is a big part of that. I can't deal with all the rest of it right now. I just want to feel better for this moment. And so that's what ends up happening. It's been looking big picture. When you're under stress, you just grab that first, whatever it is, misperception, bad habit, you know, thought error. And I think at the end of the day, that's what racism is. It's a thought error. And it's reinforced by institutions. And that's how it's taken out of that individual realm. And it becomes institutional. When you sit at the bus stop and all the buses going by have only white people on them, when you go to school and are learning and all the books have only white people represented in your social media, your educational media, your health-centered media, all these things create an illusion. And I think that's the biggest piece. It allows us to deny that these things are happening. And that's, you know, it's fairly complex when you think about it. And when you're asking someone under duress to try and peel that layer back, it's very difficult to do that. So I think that's one of the other obstacles we've had to calling racism a public health crisis, because, you know, there's a great meme right now going around, and it is that privilege is that idea that if it's not my problem, it's not a problem. And so I think that's one of the biggest obstacles we have right now, is to get people to understand that just because you have the privilege of denial of this issue doesn't mean it's not an issue. And I think that's one of the biggest obstacles. I think the other obstacle is that once you declare something a crisis, a public health crisis, then again, that funding mobilizes, the dominoes fall, and people are terrified with this sort of, okay, then what? Am I going to lose my privilege? Does that mean it's going to cost me something? And again, we can see what's happening with the virus. You know, people with privilege are having those privileges taken away. And that's one of the things we're seeing. We're seeing people resist the loss of privilege.
Leslie, if our listeners are interested in supporting your work, how can they do that?
Well, there's lots of different ways. We tried to make it pretty easy, but especially in this time where economic concerns, you know, sort of pretty much hit everybody, we're making it really, really easy to help. First, there's a moveon.org petition. Won't cost you anything. You can go to moveon.org and type in racism and public health, and we'll come up. We're asking folks to go ahead and sign it, send it over to your email list and contacts and social media and, you know, however you can share it, because we're really trying to get that number up over 100,000, at which point there's sort of a soft mandate for the target of the campaign to go ahead and contact, reach out, make a statement, hit us up. You know, okay, I heard you've been calling me out. What do you want? You know, this sort of thing. The other way you can do it is you can go to Amazon Smile. That's a giving campaign through Amazon where whatever purchases you make, you can lock it into your computer, Amazon Smile. So whenever you go to Amazon, you can choose Right to Health, Inc. as your charity. So that whenever you buy something at Amazon, you know, just a tiny little bit, like I said, it won't cost you anything. A little bit of it will donate to the nonprofit. So that's another way you can do it. You can make a donation, and that's on the righttohealthus.org website. You can, you know, just make a flat out donation. Another way that you can do it, though, is to just very simply be aware of bias in your own life. And that can take some help. And that's another part of what we do. We help groups, individuals, you know, other institutions, committees, commissions, et cetera. We help them understand what it looks like to have an anti-racist approach. And it's not enough to say I'm not a racist. You have to be actively anti-racist. And so, you know, that's another way that people can help, is by approaching and doing that self-assessment when you walk down the street and you have sort of a quick reaction to something, you know, whether it's to clutch that purse in the elevator when a Black person's on it, or that little bit of aversion to, you know, listening to a a word or a sound or a facial expression or things like that. Do some personal self-assessment. And there are lots of excellent tools online. You know, a lot of people have done a lot of excellent work in this regard, just helping people to recognize the signs of othering in the individual. And you can do, you know, that will be helpful as well. But a lot of it is just plain old have compassion. Look at yourself and understand your privilege. And that's the other thing I tell people is recognize and utilize your privilege. And it may be scary. Very often it's scary. And that's the other thing. It's about courage. It's about what do you want your world to look like? How do you want to show up in this world? And that can be tough for some people. That can be real tough. It calls for people to reassess their self-image. You know, instead of thinking to yourself, I'm not a racist, you can stop and think to yourself, but am I an anti-racist? Right? You can see the subtle difference there. But there are lots of ways you can help. And, you know, a brilliant anti-racist activist that I know once said, if you want to work on this, do you. Just do you with an anti-racist approach. And that means, you know, whatever it is that you do, if you're a quilter, you know, look around at your quilting group and say, hey, when was the last time we actually reached out to someone who doesn't look like us? If you're a religious person, you know, how about go to that church on the other side of town where, you know, maybe we can be a sister church, switch preachers for a Sunday or two, have an intervention with that group. Let's have an event. Let's partner, you know, reach out, because connection is the antidote for hate. And I think that's an important piece as well. Reach out. And the current vitriol and separating verbiage out of our leadership has been particularly unhelpful. So the way to fix that, to counter it with unity, counter it with reaching out, attempting to connect. I think that's another way people can help. Just look around, standing in that line at the grocery. You know, did that person overlook the person of color in front of you? Then speak up and say, hey, he or she was here first. You know, just little acts of kindness, little acts of inclusion every day are presented to us if we only look, if we only try to find them. You know, a smile. Gee, I noticed you're the only person sitting here alone. Can I sit by you? Gee, you know, that kind of thing. It's as simple as that, and it's as big as that.
Right, not asking people to take on the world on their own. Is there anything
exactly
like,
right.
Yeah. Is there anything else that we should cover before we wrap up?
I think one thing that I would ask for people to do is to be just a little more sensitive in terms of looking around and a little less sensitive in terms of getting one's feelings hurt. Sensitive is such a, it's an interesting word. And very often people of color have been accused of being overly sensitive. Well, I didn't mean it that way. You just took it, you know, you're oversensitive. I didn't mean it that way. What I would ask people to do in their daily lives is to be a little more sensitive with regard to other, and a little less sensitive with regard to self. In other words, you know, think about someone else's feelings before you speak and be a little less ready to be triggered by someone else's words to you. So if someone says something like, you know, wow, that hurt my feeling, you can be that person who says, okay, let me look at what it was that hurt your feelings so that I can do better. Not have that reflex of, no, I didn't. You see, it's a very small step. But if we can begin to de-escalate ourselves, then I think the hope for de-escalating our world increases.
That was Leslie Gregory of Right to Health speaking with KBOO's Althea Billings.